Hi, everybody. Welcome to our next episode of Future Focus CXOs. I have a very special guest today, Alan Rassen. He's the Chief Information Officer for a very fastest growing bank in the Southeast called Encore. And Alan, welcome to our podcast. And do you mind introducing yourself?
Yeah, of course. Good to see you guys on 2D. Yeah, I am responsible for technology and innovation for a bank called Encore Bank, based out of the southeastern part of the United States. We're only about 4 years old, but have grown pretty rapidly on the commercial side of the business, which we'll talk about. But my responsibility as Chief Innovation Officer for Encore, broadly responsible for tech and innovation for the company.
Okay, thank you. Welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Yesterday itself, I was talking to someone and he was asking, how did you land up in Atlanta? I said, it's a long story, but it's a very non-linear, right? I never thought about Atlanta. I just came up and it just happened. But I think being an entrepreneur and what you have done and where you are, one important aspect I would like to know from you, you have built a good brand. Everybody feels like building a brand with social media is easy. But once you start that journey, you remember it is not easy. It is a lot of grind, a lot of sweat, lot of strategies, and there is no book of who teaches you how to do it.
Yeah.
So share with us your journey of how you are doing it and what has worked for you and what has not worked for you.
Yeah, that's a great question. Speaking of nonlinear, that would be another example. I have been very fortunate in life, career, etc. I've had an opportunity and won a pretty significant award a year and a half ago from American Banker, their Digital Banker of the Year award. Whether I deserved it or not, whole other question, but when they gave it to me, I graciously accepted it. But it has been fantastic. It has created so many opportunities to do things, meet people, travel, go speak at conferences. I love all of that stuff. The reality is that those things don't have a very long shelf life, but it has created just an opportunity to do some things that I've always wanted to do. Have a real affinity outside of banking for music, film production in general, and to use that interest and that passion to launch a YouTube channel, do some things on social media, which is all fun. Certainly not making any money from it, probably never going to make any money from it. If I do, I've got a plan to donate it all to charities that support education, which is certainly an emphasis. But I think what it comes down to your question about brand is like just being genuine, authentic as best you can. Mm-hmm. I am who I am. I'm 47, probably couldn't change if I wanted to. Might as well double down on just being genuine. And from a social and content creation perspective, try to deliver things that help people, whether it's financial, education, or otherwise. That's what it comes down to for me. And I always think about this. I was like, you know what? If nothing else happens in this whole YouTube thing, for example, at worst, my kids may watch it one day and get some insights from old dad on financially related stuff. So if that's the worst thing that happens, it's all good.
I believe that would be the best thing to happen, right?
Yeah, exactly.
I never thought about that. You can literally speak to your generations in ways that were never before. I never even thought of that. But the other element of that is that you get the opportunity to speak into the generations where it's not like, oh, you remember what dad said? You're like, no, here's the link to remember what dad said.
In theory, it'll last forever, at least until Google sells and becomes something different and decides that YouTube is not a primary business.
Hey, let me take you back to banking a little bit. A question. Right. I know we definitely like this idea of personal branding, but when I was thinking about the decisions around innovation, am I buying this or am I building this? Mm-hmm. I'd love your opinion on how you figure out a way to make a decision around that, because that's a critical function right now as everyone invested heavily in technology in the last three or four years due to the pandemic, but now they're having to make different decisions and they're being a lot more thoughtful. So what is a way you strike a balance for those successful outcomes?
Yeah, a couple of things that I would share. First and foremost, building is a long, expensive process. And in this space, banking, fintech, et cetera, the thing's changing pretty fast. There's a lot of fintech, bank tech out there that have developed fantastic products and platforms for banks. Why not leverage those? You know, there's up until about a year ago, there was a ton of venture capital flowing into the fintech and bank tech space. And where that happens, those fintechs can leverage that capital and build great products that banks would struggle to build and deliver. So our thesis is built on time. It's not unlimited and we can't get it back. So how do we leverage it as best we can? It's way oversimplified, but in all honesty, there's an expectation. Our clients, and specifically like businesses that we bank, have an expectation of a certain level of quality in terms of digital delivery, and they ain't going to wait 2 years to get it. So being able to take fintech off the shelf, being able to take product in general off the shelf and integrate it into our environment is pretty mission critical. In this space, we tend not to build. We tend to buy, try to negotiate contracts that are relatively short term in nature. We know things are going to change 2 years from now, 3 years from now. So no 5, 6, 7 year contracts, we can help it. Reevaluate after 2 years, see where the market is, et cetera. But I think the one caveat that I might offer to that is, whether it's banking or otherwise, if there are components to your business that are just mission critical, you need to own those as often as you can. That is a tough thing for the lower end of the banking industry. 3,500, 4,000 banks today. Many of them are community, small regionals, smaller balance sheets than the big money centers. So it's tough to own it, which means you got to develop it and build it yourself. But I would just challenge people to think about it maybe that way as often as they could. What are the mission critical components of this business? And maybe orient yourself around owning those versus buying them. Easier said than done in a lot of cases.
Yesterday, I was at a conference. It was Commerce Connect. And I was listening to SVP from Truist Bank. Right? It was a panel discussion. And a very interesting question came up, which I wanted to ask you as well. And the guy said that 15 years back, when a startup might have come to you, what would have been your answer? And what's your answer today? He dodged it really well, saying that our answer could have been very different. Another big question or poll that they took was, how many of us truly trust that our data is safe with the bank? And not even 3 people raised their hand. So what that tells you, that even though we have all our financial data and all our money in the bank, how much trust we really do in terms of exposing it online, sharing with others, and this frauds happening. So the question really is that, how do you keep your data secure? Keep consumer data secure from a bank's perspective, but don't hurt the user experience. Because what happens is, in terms of securing, the experience becomes terrible, right? And conventionally, we have never loved online banking. So how do you balance that?
That is a struggle in this space. And you're talking to somebody that grew up on the business side of banking, that very client focused, client centric, who is now on the tech and innovation side of the industry. And I candidly struggle with that question a lot. As I look at some of the safeguards that exist in this industry to do exactly what you're talking about, which is protect our data, our PII, our social security numbers, our birthdays, our financial information, et cetera. Like, that's mission critical stuff. And the industry clearly is very highly regulated, but the industry definitely skews towards the side of protection versus UX versus the experience that we all kind of share in this digital journey. That's a fine line. I do not have the answer to that. That is something that we're all trying to figure out. How do we create just a fantastic experience, which in a lot of cases means efficiencies? I don't want to go into so many different examples, but I don't want to go into my online banking and have to validate passwords and security codes. And it drives me crazy as much as it drives the consumer crazy. But at the same time, I also don't want my financial information in the wrong hands, not because I'm necessarily nervous or scared about my bank account being cleaned out, but it's just a mess. Like, that information gets out there and you can't get it back. Maybe, it's a long process, a mess, a nightmare to clean that up when it happens. But I personally, to answer your question directly, I take a lot of comfort in the fact that the industry does skew very much towards the protection and safety side, in some cases in direct conflict with the user experience, but you got to give somewhere.
Yeah, because I'll tell you something that really amazed me was when I got this Apple card through Apple, and a physical, very nice titanium card came in the post. It has nothing. It has no numbers. It has nothing on it. It's not a conventional credit card, you can see. And the best experience was, I just had to take the card closer to my iPhone to activate it. Mm-hmm. That's it. No calling. There's no number. There's nothing on it. And the experience was so nice. But I felt, and maybe because it's Apple, yeah, they have been very stringent about privacy and security and all, I said, okay, I trust this. But if some other bank might have done that, it could have scared hell out of me.
Yeah.
Right? Saying that, how are they doing this? Oh my goodness, this is scary.
It's a great point.
But that is what consumers expect, right? They expect that kind of experience. As I can lock my credit card today, going on an app very easily, why can't I lock my digital profile?
Mm-hmm.
My credit history, saying that I lock it, nobody has access to it. Give me a simple button. Those kind of things will make or build that trust, I believe, right? I'm absolutely with you. I don't want to go away from having two-factor authentication, okay? I don't want that, right?
But you also have to be fair, right? Alan, you've got a 21-year-old son, right? His expectation of privacy is completely different than your
father. Totally different. Yeah.
Totally different. And so his expectations as access, your father's like, is my money safe?
Yeah.
Do I feel safe putting my money with this sub-regional bank instead of the big bank or whatever? Yeah. You saw that with Silicon Valley failing. It's like everybody moved their money to a bigger bank just to be safe. And the understanding, and I get that, as you're younger, you're invincible. You don't have the same impression, right? Like, but it won't be a big deal until you get your stuff stolen. And as you also gain assets as we get older, right? Now we have more to protect and we don't want to risk.
That's right. That's exactly what I was going to say. My soon-to-be 21-year-old's name is Will. And at 21, you got fewer commas in your bank account, in theory, than you do later on in life. You can take a little bit more risk.
Let me ask you that. You've mentioned that you have this passion for music and video production. And I just love that. And how has that impacted your professional journey? Like, how does this creative side of you impact the way you foster innovation at the bank?
Great question. I guess I'd go back to Steve Jobs. He took a class in creative writing or script or something completely different than where he ended up building his career in one of the most important companies in the history of the world. But he did that purposefully because he knew that he would learn things over here that could conceivably be applied over here. And that just always struck me. And he told the story. I'm going to have to go pull this up so I can remember the exact details. But what he learned in that script development class, like he was able to apply at Apple in some of the packaging and things like that of the products that we buy today. And that's just always stuck with me. I love the creative side anyway, but I always learn things that I can apply, whether I know it at the time or not. I tend to learn things that I can apply back on the business side or the banking side or life in general. I guess that's just my MO. Plus, it's a great outlet getting out of the stress of being in a company and running a company and trying to build a company. Something about the strings on a guitar or film production that kind of takes you out of your day-to-day element and helps you clear your mind a little bit.
Yeah, I have learned about the idea of the creative endeavor or learning a new skill is what gives you the dopamine that keeps you energized. And if you don't have that and your job is on autopilot, creatives tend to get miserable at good jobs because there's no growth in it. And so having all these other types of things that they have to get better at keeps them engaged in all the work that they're doing.
At least I'm learning as I go. But to your point, creatives have to have that off-ramp to really be able to explore and improve in an area that isn't necessarily your day-to-day.
Alan, you have a ton of experience into fintech. You have a very creative mind, right? What is your take on the future of fintech, where it is going in terms of technology adoption, customer expectations, and last but not least, how do you plan to keep Encore Bank ahead of this curve?
Literally, we were talking about that earlier this week. The development of an innovation roadmap is a tough objective, but something that we have to stay focused on. And I would say even today, when this economic cycle has created a ton of strain on bank balance sheets, banks tend having, I'm not that old, but I am old enough to have been through the dot-com bust in the early 2000s, the 08-09 crisis, this cycle, whatever we're calling this non-recession that we're having. Banks tend to become pretty inwardly focused, and we got to take care of what's right in front of us. But part of my role is to help us think a little bit farther down the road. How do we stay relevant 2 years from now, 5 years from now, 10 years from now? The first thing I think about is I know that we're going to get through this cycle. It's just how it works. It's painful to go through. Hopefully, we're over halfway home with respect to getting through this cycle. But a year from now is going to pay dividends. What we do today is going to pay dividends 2 years from now. As I think about it, we try to silo into segments. What do we need to focus on with a 2-year time horizon? What do we need to focus on with a 5-year time horizon? What do we need to focus on with sort of a 7 to 10 year time horizon? And those things in that 2-year window certainly would include, what are we doing with digital, whether it's account opening, lending, et cetera? What are we doing with this? How are we going to deliver and monetize this, these products or these channels or whatever it is? You think about moving data. Clearly, APIs are today's mechanism to be able to move data efficiently. So the development of a data strategy is certainly mission critical. Those are in the 2-year horizon. 5-year horizon, what are we going to do about payments? What does instant payments look like in the future? What is the expectation of the middle market and small business client going to be as it relates to payments and moving money efficiently alongside that? Like, how do we deliver that and monetize it? Trying to figure things like that out. And then longer term, there's no magic to the buckets, but longer term, 7, 8, 9, 10 years out, clearly tech and AI, machine learning is going to make us all more efficient. So how do we harness that? I mean, I talk about this a lot. Banks have two things that are just so important to our business that don't necessarily exist in other businesses. And those two things, like, banks have huge client sets, especially on the consumer side of the business. And alongside those huge client sets, like, we have huge data sets as well. You know, we have massive amounts of transaction data that can be harnessed. And those two things, big client sets, big data sets, are gold as you think about machine learning and a lot of what we're seeing evolve today. To answer your question, that's how we at least think about innovation, staying relevant, roadmap, et cetera. No magic to it. It is definitely not perfect, but it's something that we have to stay focused on, even though, you know, we're dealing with an economic cycle at the moment.
Yeah, it's hard to put method to innovation, honestly. Mm-hmm. A lot of disruptors keep coming, and you never can predict where things are going to go. But in keeping a 1-year, 2-year horizon, rather than trying to plan way too ahead and invest something which may not happen or something completely different might happen, is a good strategy of thinking about it. Yes, but investing in innovation is important. But I think with this fintech happening, there is a lot of data sharing expectations from your partners. Like, you guys have started showing FICO score now. So it's coming from the scoring engines for you. Mm-hmm. At the same time, you are sharing certain information with the partners and with third parties and other things. And it's a very nice analogy I heard yesterday. I wanted to say it here, was that the CIO said, think that I give you $1,000 to invest. How would you invest that? Versus, I told you, you invest your $1,000. The whole strategy is different the moment it's your money, right? And similar thing happens when it is my data, my organization data. My strategy is very different on sharing versus when it's your data, how I would like to share with you, right? It was a very interesting analogy. And I think that is where the core dent is going to happen of how securely and effectively we are really able to share the data.
You're talking to a person who has built a career on lending someone else's money and trying to get it back with interest. So that definitely resonates. And as it relates to the AI topic, that is obviously a very real-time topic. And I've invested the time, listened to a lot of podcasts, done a lot of reading on it. Certainly this dilemma that I think we're in right now between closed versus open environments. Open. That is definitely something that we're going to have to figure out as a society. I guess I take some comfort in the fact that between the United States and China, those are your two major players in that space, and primarily because they have the balance sheets to be able to invest in that tech. That's talking about very expensive technology to build, manage, maintain, et cetera. Not every country in the world can really participate today. So that does keep it somewhat confined, but definitely something to pay attention to.
I actually have one more question. I want to hear a situation where you had a career challenge that ended up with a positive outcome. How that might have influenced your approach to innovation and problem solving. So just looking over the arc of your career journey, a situation that ended up with a positive outcome, but was extremely challenging and caused a lot of reasons to hit the music.
I would have to say This is totally off the cuff. I would have to say, looking back over that arc, and we were talking about kids earlier, I came to a point career-wise where I was faced with a scenario where Candidly was in a pretty high-paying job and chose to leave that job to go launch a startup from scratch. Took a lot of risk, got a second mortgage on my home to be able to put the capital together to go launch this fintech, and was effectively in career transition and really had my eyes open to the opportunities that exist in this intersection of tech and finance, banking, et cetera. A lot of anxiety, young kids, a mortgage, all the things. Still did it, still took a lot of risk, and looking back, would do it again 10 out of 10 times. Maybe do a little bit differently. Let's get this side thing a little bit farther along before we leave the high-paying job. Definitely some learning in there, but I was good at what I was doing on the banking side. The technology and innovation entrepreneur side was an unknown to me at the time. And I just distinctly remember, I'm like, man, I could be making the worst mistake of my entire life here, but if the worst thing that happens is I fall flat on my face, I will have learned so much in a short period of time that I have confidence that I could pick myself up, bootstrap myself, so to speak, with that new knowledge and go make something of it.
There's a saying, right? When you fail, you don't start from scratch, right? You start with good experience.
Right. Yep. So, look, we could all go to zero financially tomorrow, but what we still have, even in a bad scenario like that, is we have a ton of experience and a ton of subject matter expertise and knowledge that we can go rebuild from. So that's what I tell my kids, to be honest with you. Have confidence in yourself, learn, and keep learning. That's where it's at. If you're after dollars, that's how you're going to get them. But regardless, you got to keep learning and evolving.
Awesome.
I love that question.
Yeah, thanks. I want to throw a pointed question at that. So how has the experience that you have and that willing to risk, not every risk pays off, and that affects a business, which could end up in special assets. When the downturn, you saw the mortgage industry go through craziness. I was in the .com. I was the first banker who had seen a recession in 30 years, for the most part. They didn't know what to do with this.
Yeah,
and having to walk clients through that was a big impact. Was there anything in that mindset of helping someone who tried and failed, which is always a hard way to get back into banking, get back into lending, get back into the good graces of access to capital? How do you see that? Is there anything technologically that sort of helps bridge that, where it's either keeps them from failing or maybe able to support them after they fail? Is there anything that you see or have been thinking about to leverage that to honor those that are willing to do what you did?
Yeah, always take some risk. That's how we evolve. That's how we learn. We always used to, on the business side, where we're putting capital into companies, I always think back to like diversity in revenues, for example. Mm-hmm. We struggled to put capital into businesses that had very little diversity in their revenue stream. We got a $20 million company here, but they've got two clients. That's a problem. Mm-hmm. You lose one of those clients. Like, our guidance was always like, we got to have diversity in the revenue streams and not have concentrations. That's probably a better word, across the balance sheet or the P&L. And I take that approach in kind of life, I guess, as well. Yes, I will take risks. No, I will not take risks that I'm not going to bet the farm on one thing. If you think about it like a financial investment, taking 5% of total risk, 5% of the balance sheet, 10% of the balance sheet, not 50% of the balance sheet. So when you miss, it's not hugely catastrophic, is my MO. Having lent a lot of money over the years and thousands of transactions and hundreds of millions of dollars out the door, you fine-tune that ability to not double down, but not have huge concentrations and diversity in whatever you're doing from a financial perspective. I hope that answers your question.
It did. Excellent. Jay, is there anything else you want to say to wrap up?
No, I think the typical last thing I ask, which everybody wants to listen, is what advice would you give to people who are aspiring to where you are?
Totally off the cuff. I think you got to be humble as you go about all of this. You got to recognize that you don't know it all. There's a lot of unknowns. You try to bring in the best information that you can to make a decision, but it's never going to be perfect. A lot of that information is going to conflict with itself. Trust your instincts, but at the same time, be humble enough to take account, look back on things and be like, yeah, that went great. I screwed that up. Could have done this differently. Take all of that in stride and, don't make the same mistakes twice, certainly, but be humble enough to acknowledge the things that went well and the things that didn't go well on this innovation journey.
Great. Okay. Thank you so much, Alan, for spending time with us today.